Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I can't complain. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. This is The Wright Show. You are Bob Cullen. You've been on Blogging Heads once before, although in a different capacity. There you were talking about your mission as a teacher of low-income kids. And I think we talked a little about golf last time. This time we're going to talk a lot about golf, at least ostensibly. At the surface level, this will seem to be about the Masters, Tiger Woods, golf. But more deeply, this will be about mythic matters, spiritual matters, maybe self-helping matters. And I actually kind of mean that. I mean, golf is, in my mind, an interestingly rich sport that touches on things like this. And by way of establishing your credentials, by the way, in addition to being a journalist of long standing, you are a golf writer. You co-wrote the mega bestseller, Golf is Not a Game of Perfect, with Bob Rotella, the famous golf psychologist. And then you wrote the book Why Golf by yourself, a question that has occurred to every golfer. Why golf? And you're a good golfer, too.
Not as good as I once was, but...
Well, who among us is?
That's right. Tiger and I have suffered a similar decline in our capabilities.
I've seen many golf writers compare you to Tiger in that regard, among others, Bob. Now let's, for the benefit of those who aren't golf fans, why don't we establish, you know, the basic outlines of the fascinating story of Tiger's downfall. I mean, at one point, you know, he was, I think few would deny, in his 20s, he's now 39, in his 20s he was the greatest that the game had ever seen. Everyone assumed he was destined to break Jack Nicklaus's treasured record of 18 majors wins, and he had indeed won 14 by his early 30s, very early 30s. And generally speaking, for a golfer, the 30s are part of your prime, you know, up until you get into the late 30s. So everything was fine, more or less. I mean, he had some quirks maybe, but then why don't you tell us what happened?
Well, he suffered a tragic fall. As any golf fan can tell you, it began probably with the way his body was breaking down. By the time he won his last major in 2008 at the U.S. Open, he was playing on a broken leg, essentially, and he needed surgery right after that. And then, probably even more critically for him, the next year, he had a spectacular explosion of his marriage. And it turned out that he had been a world-class philanderer as well as a world-class golfer. And eventually he and his wife divorced, which left him as the absentee father of two kids, whom he apparently quite genuinely cares about and wants to be a good father to.
Yeah.
And in the years that followed, he had occasional returns to form, but his body kept betraying him. And I think that... Well, you're correct that in a lot of cases, the 30s, the mid-30s, the late 30s can be a golfer's prime. Tiger put a lot of miles on the odometer at a very early age, put a lot of stress on his body.
Because he had such an athletic, almost violent swing. I mean, I always thought he swung harder than he had to, but he put a lot of stress on his knees in the course of making that turn. I don't want to give short shrift to the drama of his marriage's breakup, by the way. I mean, the first we heard of this was, it was right around Thanksgiving 2009, I think, we heard, well, Tiger Woods was in an auto accident. You're like, what? Turns out he drove into a neighbor's fire hydrant, apparently while being chased by his golf club wielding wife, who was smashing the windows out of his car with a golf club as he tried to escape her wrath. She had just discovered a mistress on his cell phone and had kind of dialed the mistress, who answered thinking it was Tiger. And then so the whole thing unraveled and it was kind of amazing. So yeah, there is that. Now, sorry, I didn't mean to derail you, but you're right that it is. Well, I'll say one other thing. So there was the physical deterioration. I'm not sure that would have done him in had it not been for this marriage thing. What's interesting is that now he has developed a mental problem, right, as well as a physical problem with his golf. Isn't that your read?
Well, he definitely seems to have a case of the chip yips, which is a golf term that means that when he needs to hit a short little shot from around the green and get it close enough to the flag to either go into the hole or to be an easy one putt, he tends to do what a lot of people, myself included, who are not professional golfers do, which is he either hits the grass behind the ball or he sculls the ball and sends it over the green and winds up making an embarrassingly high number on a hole where he normally in his prime would have made an easy par. And the chip yips generally are considered to be partly a physical problem, partly a mental problem, and the two feed on each other, the two aspects of it. And he was definitely showing the chip yips the last few times he tried to compete. He now seems to be better, but it remains to be seen whether in the crucible of pressure that will be the Masters this weekend for him, his demons don't return.
Right. Things got so bad that he took some time off from golf some weeks ago and hasn't competed in any tournament since then. And there was all this suspense. Is he going to play the Masters? The answer is yes, he's going to play the Masters. And you're right, the yips are a fascinating phenomenon. The chip yips are a subset of the yips. The most common manifestation of the yips is putting. That's when you usually hear it. You know, you've got a little 4-foot putt should be makeable, and you kind of freak out and you twitch and you miss it.
That's the traditional definition or the traditional manifestation of the yips, but it tends to come from the fact that in a bygone era, there was really only one putting method and one size club and for putting with. And so if you got the yips, you were stuck with them. The yips would mean that when you had a short putt, you'd have a little twitch or an involuntary flick of your wrists and you'd send the ball past the hole. Typically, nowadays, modern golfers will experiment with different grips, different size putters, and so forth, and find a way to paper over their putting yip problems. And where you hear about the yips more often now tends to be in the short game, the chips and pitches around the green that are very important in an overall score. And Tiger probably brought the problem on to some degree in two ways. One is that he keeps experimenting with different swing techniques and different swing teachers. And so suddenly he had somebody telling him something a little different, and he was trying something that wasn't natural for him when he was around the greens. And then the second thing is that when you have physical problems in the knees and the back, the way he has had them, that can show up in the way that your body performs during a small swing. And the two then feed on each other. And the kind of unconscious grace that he had when he was in his 20s seems to have deserted him.
Right. Now, unconscious grace, that's a fascinating phrase, because golf is such a head game. And I speak as someone who, I always have the chip yips and the pit. I mean, you've actually played with me. You know, I don't know if you remember which particular aspect of my horrendous golf game was the most grotesque, but it is the chipping and the pitching, because when you're in that twilight zone between a full swing and just a simple putt, for me, I just have trouble not thinking about it too much. And thinking is what gets in the way of golf, which brings us back to your term unconscious. I mean, this is what fascinates me about golf, is that, people who don't play golf think, well, it shouldn't be that hard. The ball is standing still. But that is the hard part, because it means that you are not, you know, kind of, your swing isn't triggered by like a baseball pitch, which turns it into a reflex action, right? You are thinking you can swing at any time, and so you have the option of totally overthinking it and screwing up.
That's right. The research in sports psychology and in a lot of other branches of psychology suggests that motor skills are best governed by subconscious parts of the mind. And if you start to think and start to try to control things, then you're going to interfere with the motor skills that are required to do the deft little motion that chipping or pitching involves. And Tiger, I think if you watched him in his prime, you probably saw any number of enormously successful brilliant little chips and pitches. There was one on the 16th green at the Masters in 2005, I believe, where he overshot the green from the tee, and he had this little chip shot, and he played it about 20 feet to the left of the hole, knowing that the slope of the green would carry the ball down toward the hole. And at the very last half revolution, the ball plopped in the hole, and he made a birdie, and he won the tournament.
Yeah, this was just like designed for Nike, because he was using a Nike golf ball, and it rolled down, and then it paused on the top of the cup with the Nike logo showing, and then fell, and that was like replayed 7 jillion times.
I can remember a shot that he played in the President's Cup sometime in the early 2000s. He was playing in a match against Vijay Singh at Robert Trent Jones out in Gainesville, Virginia. And Singh hit the par 5 13th green in two shots. Tiger had his ball just off the green in two, but he was at the top of a very steep tier. And if he putted the ball or chipped it, he would hit the tier and roll way past the hole. And there was a pond beyond the green. He nevertheless took his wedge, opened it up with a very tight lie, just on the fringe of the green, and took a full swing and hit a tremendous flop shot that stopped about 2 feet from the hole, bypassed the swale in the green entirely. And he halved that hole with Singh, and Singh was so deflated by watching that the rest of the match was anticlimactic and Tiger beat him.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, one place he used to always win was in the psychological game. And that's why it is so shocking to see him suffering from a psychological malady that seems to have to do with some kind of loss of self-confidence, because he just never had any doubt that he was going to win. And that was part of his power as a golfer. And it's just amazing if you followed him in his 20s to see him now seem, psychologically frail.
Well, I think that it's part of the human process. A lot of kids are very confident in their 20s, and they start getting knocked around by life a little bit, and suddenly they recognize the potential for failure within themselves, and their self-confidence tends to change and to wither. And I think Tiger is now going through something very similar to what most of us go through, where he's got to try to figure out a way to repress the memories of the bad shots, the bad chips, and the bad pitches that he hit in his most recent competitions, and somehow bring his mind back to the way it was at the 2005 Masters or in the President's Cup against Vijay Singh, where he sees what he needs to do. He has enormous confidence that he can do it, and he just lets the swing happen.
Yeah.
Whether he can get back to that state is something I'll be very impressed if he can, because it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, and we should say that although I personally think the breakup of his marriage has something to do with the trouble he's gone through since, he has had his good spells. I mean, he was golfer of the year a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago. He won, I think, maybe 5 tournaments, and as recently as 2 years ago, I think he won 3. And he just has not won any majors. He has not, since he was, I guess, 32 or something, 32 or 33, whenever. 32,
yeah.
2008, that spectacular win at the U.S. Open, he has not won a major. And the odds you could have gotten if you had bet, like when he was 30, if you had said, I'll bet you he won't win a major after he's 32, people would have given you like 500-1 odds or something. And now it looks like it may happen that he never wins another major. In any event, he's got to win 4 of them. You know, there are 4 majors a year. He's got to win 4 majors to tie Nicklaus's record, which was always his explicit goal. He was very clear about it. Well, his explicit goal was to break the record, and that would be 5 wins. He's got to do that at this point. And I kind of think one thing that may happen to him is he has finally realized, as full of self-confidence as he naturally has been, I think it at some point dawned on him that he may well not break Nicklaus's record. And I've got to think, I mean, that realization has to have come within the last couple of years. And I got to think that would be a kind of a traumatic insight to endure. What do you think of that theory?
You're probably right. I don't know when that realization really might have come to him, because he has never, I don't think, expressed any doubt that he can do it. But Yeah, I think that in an oblique kind of way, he has talked about how players who've come along who were in diapers when he was winning his first Masters, like Jordan Spieth, who's one of the favorites this week, like Rory McIlroy, who's 13 years younger than Tiger, and they have not been intimidated by Tiger in his prime the way that the older generation of players was intimidated by Tiger. And they're not afraid of him the way that some of these other guys were. And they don't feel that they have to play perfect golf in order to beat him, which is a terrible thing to be thinking as you're playing around the golf. And so their chances of surpassing him in a head-to-head competition, I think, are a lot better, regardless of how well Tiger happens to be playing. Whereas in the past, the, say, with Phil Mickelson or somebody in that generation, he would step onto the first tee and Phil or Davis Love would know, if I don't play perfect golf, I'm not going to win. And when you're trying to play perfectly, you're putting too much pressure on yourself. You're getting too conscious of what you're doing. You're not likely to do it. So what Tiger saw again and again was that rivals would play less than their best when they came up against him in a major championship. That's not necessarily going to happen with Rory McIlroy or Jordan Spieth or Jason Day or any of the other young contenders.
Yeah, and you know, he has only himself to blame for their existence, because these are guys who I think many of them were inspired by Tiger Woods. When they were 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, he was on top of the world. And for the first time in a while, it was like cool to play golf because it was Tiger Woods. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like Jack Nicklaus or some boring white guy. It was Tiger Woods. And so he inspired this generation of competition that he now faces. And there's now, as you said, all these great young guys coming up.
Well, yeah, it is his fault in a sense. And Rory McIlroy will tell you, there's a story that when he was 9 years old, he wrote a letter to Tiger saying, "I'm coming after you." There's no evidence that Tiger ever read it. But Rory had it in his mind. And, 10, 15 years later, yeah, he's beating Tiger. He's number one, and Tiger is now number 111.
You mentioned that, he used to be able to convince players that they had to play perfectly to beat him, and that is the kiss of death, which brings us to this bestseller you co-authored called Golf is Not a Game of Perfect. So can you elaborate a little on the moral of that story, of that book, and to what extent it applies more broadly to life beyond golf?
I think that the key insight that Bob Rotella had, certainly not I, was that golf, along with a lot of other athletic pursuits and a lot of pursuits in life in general, is best played when you allow your subconscious mind to control your actions. I can imagine that a whole variety of activities, painting, photography, as well as golf and other sports, are similar in the sense that if you want your artistic talent to emerge, you can't overthink it. You can't over-intellectualize it. And yet we have been conditioned and taught in many ways that when a crisis occurs, you've got to think. You've got to be very calculating about what you do. And that's probably good advice if you're taking a math test, but not such good advice if you're playing golf or playing a musical instrument or doing anything artistic. And so the struggle in golf, the mental struggle, is about trying to use your conscious mind only for a few things that the conscious mind is best suited for, planning your strategy and so forth before the round. And then once you get into the round and once you're actually competing, try to become as unconscious as you possibly can. See a target, have confidence that you're going to hit the ball to the target, and let your subconscious mind control your swing. That's the way that great golfers, I think, have always figured out to play the game. They didn't necessarily have the terminology or the brain science that we have now, but they understood the principle. And so Byron Nelson would tell you that when he was winning 11 straight tournaments in 1945, he would frequently come to the end of a round and have no idea what he shot because he was just moving from ball to hole, see the shot, hit the shot. And then at the end, he'd add it up and figure out what he actually made. But he didn't know during the course of the round what he was doing.
Well, you know, you recount, I think, the story in your book, Why Golf, of when Ken Venturi won, I guess it was the U.S. Open, right, his major. And he was suffering from heat stroke right at the end. I mean, he was dazed, and, I mean, people were having to assist him, right, as he, like, walked down the fairway. And right. At first you go, amazing that you could win the U.S. Open under the circumstances, but when you think about it, it may have actually been an asset because it essentially shut down conscious thought, right? I mean...
Yes, and Ken Venturi, when he had been in position to win majors before that, had always choked. Choking can be defined probably as allowing your conscious mind to take over your body and take over your process and ruin your grace and your fluidity. And in the Masters in 1954, 1956, Venturi got into position to win as an amateur once, and he shot 80 in the final round. And
which is just as bad for those of you who aren't golf fans.
Yeah, and at the U.S. Open in 64, coming back from a long period of disrepair in his game, and on a day when they had to play two rounds on a very hot day in July in Washington, he was advised by a doctor after the third round, you shouldn't go out there, you could kill yourself, because it's so hot and you're almost already suffering from heat stroke and dehydration. But he said he was going to go out there, and all he could manage to do was to hit the ball, find the ball, and hit it again, and not really think about where he was and the fact that his life would change if he could manage to win the United States Open. And in that frame of mind, he did win the U.S. Open.
That's amazing. Now, speaking of these kind of, you know, some might say even spiritual aspects of golf, I mean, the sense in which it requires a kind of self-mastery, and the self-mastery in turn requires a certain kind of flow, or, you know, a kind of, there's a Chinese word for it, whatever, you know, kind of. There is a kind of famous book on golf as a, it's a kind of a mystical view of golf called Golf in the Kingdom, by Michael Murphy, whom I actually met once. Mm-hmm. I've got to say, when I tried to read the book, I didn't totally get it. Does that book have an agreed upon message? And if so, does it make sense to you? I assume you've read it.
I did read it. And I think that it's a different take on the same idea. Mm-hmm. That there is a large part of golf that is mental, that in order for this American character in the novel to learn to play golf well, he had to learn to get outside of himself and to sort of bond with the Scottish character Shevis Irons. And that was a conceit that in some ways might have represented the same thing, the idea that you need to get into that flow state where you're not thinking about, not trying to control what you're doing. You're just letting it happen and letting the skills that you've learned through long hours of repetition and practice manifest themselves during the course of a game that you're playing.
Yeah, there's I play occasionally here in New Jersey where I live now. I used to live in D.C. in the area, general area in which you live. And I was out with playing with some guys a few years ago, you know, I'm a total head case in any sport that permits you to be a head case, and golf permits that more than any, with the possible exception of tennis. You know, I was doing my generally horrendous job of driving, and once, you know, that is to say, you know, hitting it off the tee, and once, just for fun, I just sustained the conversation with them as I hit the tee shot. It was a spectacular shot. I mean, it was a better shot than I will hit all day on the average day. Far and away, a better drive than I hit all day. And the reason is because I was just conversing with them and not thinking about the swing. And yet, I cannot So it is within me to hit a decent drive. And by, I should say it was spectacular by my standards, which are meager, but still way, way, way better than average. And yet, it's incredibly hard to do.
Well, it is, because in golf, I'd argue with you about the possibility of tennis. The only thing in tennis that I can think of that reflects the mental challenge of golf is the serve. Because with the serve, you control the initiation of the action and you are trying to repeat a motion that you've practiced many times before. You control nearly all the variables, how high you toss the ball and so forth. The rest of tennis, you're reacting to what your opponent does. And that's different from golf. Every shot in golf is like the serve in tennis. You begin when you want to begin. You have all the time you want to think about it beforehand. And you're therefore going to play or hit the ball as well as your mind is going to let you hit it. If you hit a winner past me in tennis, it doesn't matter where my mind is. If I can't get to the ball, I'm not going to hit it well. So I would say that golf is a much more mental game than tennis. But
I think it is. The one thing I'd add two things. First of all, serve is very important in tennis. It comes into play in half of the points you play, roughly. The other thing is, in tennis, especially maybe at the kind of hacker level, there are a lot of shots where you've got plenty of time to hit the ball. It just kind of floats over and you have time to think about it. And that's what can be deadly. It's like in basketball, sometimes a player will be wide open and miss, and they'll say he had too much time to think about it. If there had been a defender up there with a hand in his face, he would have made the shot. So there is, and then the added variable in tennis is, this is maybe peculiar to me to some extent, but I remember once I was playing regularly with somebody I really didn't like. And in that case, you know, you may be in a golf tournament, there may be somebody you don't like, but they're probably not like within your field of view when you're hitting your shot. And what I was doing was I'd have plenty of time to hit the shot because it kind of floated over. I really didn't like the guy and wanted to devastate him. And that combination of things, that was an interesting kind of psychological challenge that I had to overcome. But you're right. In golf, there's almost, well, pitching in baseball, that's one other case where every time you do anything, you are not reacting and you have plenty of time to think about it. And that's why with pitchers, you know, they will just lose it like that. And that happens with a lot of golfers. Rory McIlroy has had his dips, and golfers tend to. Do you think that part of Tiger's problem is, I guess, kind of hubris? I mean, I'm kind of interested in the kind of mythic nature of his fall. I wrote a piece for New York Times a while ago, back, I don't know, after his marriage broke up, comparing it to The Natural, you know, by Bernard Malamud, and the movie starred Robert Redford, this baseball player who surrenders largely to his carnal desires, although the story is a little different, and he surrenders to greed more broadly, you could say. But it's a similar kind of mythic downfall. He could have been the greatest ever, and he screwed it up, and because he took it for granted. And I think you got to see some of that in Tiger, right? He kind of started taking it for granted, right?
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that what I see now is a suggestion that he realizes that he may never get back and that time is running out. I think it's very interesting that this year, in fact, as we're speaking, he is, for the first time in many years, playing in the little par-3 tournament they have on the Wednesday before the Masters begins. Most years when he was a contender, he skipped it. He didn't want to be bothered with it. This year he's playing, and the reason he's playing apparently is that his two children are now 7 and 6 years old, and the par-3 tournament is an event where girlfriends play. Rory McIlroy a couple of years ago had Caroline Wozniacki as his caddy, and wives caddy, girlfriends caddy, children caddy, and so forth. And I think it means something to Tiger that his kids get a chance to see him and in a sense participate with him in a major championship, particularly the Masters, while there's still time. I think, you know, it may well be that in the back of his mind, he's thinking, I might not be playing here in another year or two. Because not because I won't be eligible, because you can play in the Masters once you've won it until you're 65, but because my game will be so bad that I won't want the public to see it. And he wants his children to have a sense of what he was when he was playing golf. And this is one chance for them to get a really close look.
Yeah, I took it to be a very bad sign that he's doing this, playing in the par three tournament. And the other bad sign, you know, a sign that at some level he may be realizing that the party is over. The other bad sign is when I heard he's going to start a restaurant. Hey, man, there's plenty of time to start a restaurant, right? It's like, I mean, focus on, you know, it just seems to me like, when you think about it, bringing the kids to the par three thing, starting the restaurant, it just seems to me like he's starting to shift into, you know, I want into kind of image maintenance, you know, notwithstanding the whole scandal. I want people to think of me as this great guy. Come to my restaurant, see my kids. Tiger, no, focus, man.
Well, it's hard to judge. I will say this, that one of the great ironies of golf is that for most of us, at least, when you finally have all the time you want to practice, your body won't let you practice. Most of us, we play golf while we are holding down jobs and trying to advance in various ways and careers and so forth. And if we practice at all, it's a half an hour here or 20 minutes there. That doesn't really do much to improve our games. And there's a thought in the back of your mind that, wow, someday when I'm older and I have a lot of time, I'm going to really work on my golf game and I'm going to really see how good I can be. And the irony is that when that time comes, your body breaks down and it won't let you practice as much as you'd like. Tiger in his 20s, according to everybody who knew him and from what I could see, outworked everybody. I mean, he would practice from sunup to sunrise, or sunup to sundown. And you can't do that when your back is hurting and your knees are giving out and all the other ailments that he has are starting to bother you. Mm-hmm. And so I think that he is in the stage of his career where no matter what he would like, he just can't devote as much time to golf as he could when he was 25. His body will break down if he does. So it's the time of life in golfers' careers when you go into golf course architecture, which he is doing. I didn't know about the restaurant. I hadn't read that. But, you know, it's the kind of thing that a middle-aged or advanced middle-aged golfer, which is really what Tiger is, starts to try to develop as a way of capitalizing on his name and his reputation and staying in the game, but not necessarily having the skills that would be able to compete in major championships.
Yeah. We should say the part that, you know, the game's not over. I mean, he's 39. It's not, I mean, certainly if he were healthy physically and psychologically, you'd say, yeah, this guy could definitely win five majors starting at age 39. Right. I mean, we would have thought that of him 10 years ago, but
it's not very common. If you
look at some of the greats, then again, nobody had ever been like him, right?
Well, that's true. But if you look at some of the greats, Nicklaus won two when he was 40, and then he won another when he was 46.
Okay.
So he had three after the age of 40. Palmer never won a major after he was 35 years old. I can't remember how old Tom Watson was. Tom Watson, at the age of 58, came pretty close to winning the British Open a few years ago, but he had, I think, a long period where he never contended in a major because his putting stroke deserted him. And I think that while it's possible to win majors in your 40s, it's rare. And the shrewd betting would be that by this time, Tiger should have been at 17 or 18 majors if he were to stand any chance to break Jack Nicklaus's record, and that he's not going to do it because time is running out for him. Even though he's in good shape and he's by the standards of some sports, he's 39 and not out of his physical prime. He's an old golfer.
Yeah. Now, there's an interesting pattern in his career, which is that, you know, if you look at what he had done by age 31, 32, it was basically win a ton of tournaments and win a ton of majors. But there was a kind of a rhythm to it, which was that he would have a swing coach, do very well with him, and then he would get a new swing coach and a new swing. They would rebuild his swing. And this and suddenly he wouldn't be winning at the same rate. And then finally he'd get in the groove and he'd start winning with the new swing and he'd be totally on top of the game. And then he'd get the third swing coach. And I always wondered about that. There are a couple of it's strange, you know, it's like because he I think at least once and maybe twice, he got rid of the swing coach when he was on top of the world. And the question is, you know, why do you do that? Why don't you you know, dance with a girl that brung you, as they say. There are a couple of explanations, right? What is your theory as to why he did this?
I think there are two or three things. One is that Tiger, in his prime, was not a particularly pleasant personality to be around. Hank Haney, in his book about his time as Tiger's swing coach, recounts some very negative anecdotes about the way Tiger treated him, and the kind of personal relationship that they had, which was not much. And so over time, I think Tiger kind of wears out any relationship that he has with a swing coach. He wore it out with Butch Harmon, and then he wore it out with Hank Haney, and then he went to a guy named Sean Foley. And with Foley, I don't think it ever really clicked because Foley was trying to rebuild Tiger's swing with a when Tiger's body wasn't really in a position to practice as much as he once had been able to do. So now Tiger is supposedly coaching himself. He has a sports kinesiologist who kind of looks at him. He has some friends that try to look at him, but he certainly knows enough about the golf swing and his golf swing to do that if he's so inclined. But the other thing about Tiger is that I think he found it necessary to change what was really a classic winning swing because he got bored just practicing the same thing over and over again. And he needed a challenge. So he would say, you know, I got to revamp my swing. It's not quite good enough and I'm going to change it and make it better. And that would give him a challenge and something to work on and focus on. And he needed that to be able to practice as much as he did.
That's interesting. I mean, I've always thought of it as a kind of a hyper perfectionism. Like he always thought I can be even better. And it's like, you're already so much better than anyone else. Don't mess with it. But he did keep striving for more. You know, I mean, there was tons of evidence throughout the history of golf that dismantling your swing and building a new one is a very dangerous thing to do, you know? And that's when I say I think he had a certain kind of hubris. You know, the nerve to kind of do that when things are going well seems to me pretty considerable.
I agree. And I think it's one of the things that we now, in retrospect, can appreciate about Jack Nicklaus. That Nicklaus learned when he was a boy from a pro named Jack Grout at the Scioto Country Club in Columbus, Ohio. And for the rest of his playing career, until Jack Grout died, he would go back to Grout for a series of lessons at the beginning of every season and essentially re-ingrain the same fundamentals that he had been practicing since he was 12 years old. And he never tried to change his swing in any fundamental way. He'd tinker with things like when he went to Augusta, he'd be trying to draw the ball because he thought that was the proper way to play the golf course there. But he basically was trying to do the same things from the beginning of his career to the very end. And I think in retrospect, that's a much wiser way to approach it. Nicklaus kept himself from being bored by not practicing so much. When he was away from golf, he'd spend time playing tennis, he'd spend time fishing, he'd spend time watching his kids play sports. And then when it was time to go back out on the tour, he'd practice again. But he didn't practice every day all of his life. And he kept the same basic swing. And he never got tired of it the way Tiger apparently got tired of it, maybe through over-practicing and over-focusing on it when he was in his 20s.
Yeah. And there's also the story, as for his getting rid of his first swing coach, that you've probably heard this, that he thought that Butch Harmon, the swing coach, was starting to try to take too much credit. There's an anecdote where Tiger and his father are watching TV and Butch Harmon's being interviewed and Harmon saying, yeah, we're trying to do this and we're trying to do that, meaning him and Tiger. And Tiger looks at his father and they say, what do you mean we? There's only one of us swinging the golf club. Do you think there's truth to that? That would be a really petty and immature reason to get rid of somebody, you know, a partner you had success with.
Tiger has always, I guess, had a very strong sensitivity to any thought that somebody is trying to make money off of him without him being cut in on it. I can remember, for example, there was a biography by a golf writer named John Strege. It was published about 15 years ago, a Tiger Woods biography. And Tiger was at a tournament out in California, and he was walking onto the practice range. And one of the marshals, the volunteers who basically helped the tournament exist, approached him as he was entering the practice range and said, Tiger, would you sign this for me? And he showed him a copy of John Strege's biography. And Tiger looked at him very coldly and said, I won't sign it. It's not authorized. And walked past him and started practicing. And I think that he deeply resented the notion that this writer would use his story without cutting him in on a piece of the profits. And even though he's made well over $1 billion, he seems to be extremely sensitive to and antagonistic toward the idea that somebody through association with him might make a little money on his own. And I think that that's correct, that he fired Fluff Cowan as his caddy when Fluff started to get too big of an independent personality that Tiger correctly thought was based strictly on Tiger, on Fluff's association with Tiger. And I think the same thing could have happened with Butch Harmon. I think with Hank Haney, based on Haney's book, it was more a question of both of them getting tired of one another. Haney particularly getting tired of the way Tiger treated him. But in any case,
I'm skeptical, but you never know. Well, I mean, that's a kind of a self-serving account. I don't know for sure whether it's true, but it does have the effect of painting Haney in a favorable light. So I would reserve judgment personally.
Well, you're properly skeptical, but in any event, I don't think there's any question that Tiger and his management have a very strong aversion to anybody making a few dollars in by selling photographs of Tiger or doing a painting based on a photograph of Tiger at Augusta and trying to sell that on the internet. They'll sue you. And it's not that the money involved is particularly significant to somebody with Tiger's wealth, but it's the principle apparently, and he just doesn't like it. And I would say that certainly could have been a factor in the dissolution of his partnership with Butch Harmon, and certainly was with Fluff Cowan. And, it could very well be considered a character flaw on Tiger's part that probably Arnold Palmer or Jack Nicklaus wouldn't have bothered with. They would have said, well, so what? Everybody's got to make a living. And if somebody makes a living by selling a picture they made out of my tournament performance, then God bless him.
You mentioned that, Nicklaus, by virtue of being less obsessed with practicing, that allowed his body to stay intact long enough to keep winning. Is it possible that in golf, as in a lot of sports, I think, the level of play has gotten so high that you have to be obsessive to win? I don't really know what the practice habits are of the Rory McIlroys and Jordan Spieths of the world, but I do get that, you read about athletes 50, 60, 70 years ago, in baseball, they'd show up for spring training 20 pounds overweight, and now these guys, they take a few weeks off after the World Series and then hit the weight room, and I just wonder if it's possible kind of not to wear your body out in this day and age.
I think it's a legitimate question. I don't think there's any doubt that the people who are winning tournaments, people like Rory McIlroy and Jordan Spieth, began to specialize in golf and to become full-time golfers at a much younger age than, say, Jack Nicklaus did or Arnold Palmer did. Nicklaus played a lot of sports when he was a kid. He was on the high school basketball team and so on. And he practiced golf during the golf season, where today a kid like Jordan Spieth has been playing golf year-round with a lot of – in addition to the fact that he plays it year-round, he's got a lot of coaching. He's probably got a psychologist. I don't know who it is. He's got certainly swing coaches. He's got a short game coach. He's got all kinds of people, a physical trainer working with him. And so the pursuit of excellence in golf has become much more arduous, much more obsessive. And that could very well be a factor in the way that careers that once lasted into a player's 50s are going to burn out a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. I think we'd be remiss if before we end this conversation, we didn't talk a little about the kind of political emanations from the Masters and from golf generally. I mean, golf has a reputation as being a kind of a country club and hence right-wing sport. I've always thought that was a little mistaken because I've played, well, growing up, you know, my father played on these army courses where, you know, your sergeants would play with on the same course as colonels and so on. I played on municipal courses, you know, public courses. You and I played once at Rock Creek Park in Washington, and I used to say Washington was, in my whole life at Washington, that was about the only place I ever actually had a conversation with an African-American who was from Washington, D.C. You know, not like a lawyer or something, but an actual authentic native-born Washingtonian. And as you know, there's huge socioeconomic diversity on public courses. There are lots of blue-collar and lower-income people who actually play golf. They just don't play at fancy country clubs. I've always thought that that was a little bit of an unfair caricature, but at the same time, there's a lot of country clubs out there. And then there is the Masters itself, right? This southern golf course, extremely exclusive, that didn't have a female member until quite recently. And even that, right, was that Condoleezza Rice, the first female?
And another woman, a South Carolina businesswoman.
So you've got both Republicans, I'm sure. So anyway, do you have any thoughts on all this?
Well, yeah, I think Augusta is doing a little better. I think up until a few years ago, it was very fair to criticize Augusta for arrogating to itself the role of the face of American golf every year by virtue of putting on the most important tournament of the year and having it in the same place every year. Mm-hmm. And presenting an image to the world of being unwelcoming to minorities initially, although they eventually broke down on that account, and then particularly being unwelcoming to women. And I think that the people who run the Augusta National Golf Club started to hear the criticism that they were in part responsible for the declining economic health of American golf, the declining participation and so on. And in their own way, in their own time, they reacted to it by now they have a kids event where the kids come in on the Sunday before the Masters and they win a national competition for driving, putting, and chipping and so on, and that's held at Augusta. And then they've got women members, and they are very, I think, eager to let the world see the fact that they've got women members. And so they've tried, I think, in the last few years to soften that image that they had of being a very exclusive, very unwelcoming place. And I think they feel a responsibility as stewards of golf to try to help the game grow rather than contract. But there are still a lot of things that you can object to about the way Augusta goes about its business. On the other hand, I have to say that, you know, I and five or six buddies have a Masters pool going on this year, which I've done in the past. And there's something about the Masters that even somebody like Tiger, who I think when he first played in it was quite aware of the fact that it wasn't very many years before he arrived that black players were kept out of the tournament. Mm-hmm. It means a lot to him to be able to go back there, to have his kids watch him play there and so on. And So there's a certain majesty to the golf course and the tournament that is bigger even than some of the negative factors associated with the club. And you might as well, I think, just reconcile yourself to the fact that on the first full week in April, if you like golf, you're going to hear that piano music on CBS, and you're going to hear about the azaleas and the Magnolia Lane, and it means a lot to players in the game. It means a lot to golfers around the country, and you can argue with it, and you can make some valid points about Augusta, but it is what it is.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's given it its mystique is that alone among the majors, it is played at the same course every year. So viewers become familiar with these, you know, Amen Corner and so on. You kind of know the course if you watch it for a few years. And every time something important happens at any hole, there is an historical antecedent, and they can show you the videotape, you know, and...
Well, when Bob Rotella and I wrote Golf is Not a Game of Perfect, which you kindly referred to, when we wanted to write a chapter about course strategy and planning your round and how you were going to attack different holes, we created an imaginary opportunity to play holes 10 through 12 at Augusta National and how you would approach each one, 10 through 13, I take it back. And we did that knowing that anybody who read the book had very likely seen those holes over and over and over again, mm-hmm. and would respond to the notion of how would you play them if you had a chance to play the course yourself.
Okay, final question. I've got to ask you to make a pick. You can make more than one if you want in terms of who's going to win the Masters, but if so, why don't you array them in order of likelihood?
Well, my own personal pick is Jason Day of Australia. He's won a lot of near major championships. He's played very well at Augusta. He's played well this year, but he hasn't won. And I think he could very well come out on top. I've picked in my little pool, I've picked Jordan Spieth. I picked Rory McIlroy. I picked Matt Kuchar. And I picked, I can't remember who my fifth one was right now, but you've got to go, I think, a little bit on the track record of players at Augusta National because it is the same course every year. So there is a record that's a little more valuable in terms of prognostication than there would be, say, at a U.S. Open where the course changes every year. So if somebody has played the course well for several years, that gives you a sense that they understand it and they're going to take advantage of their experience. And so Spieth played very well last year, didn't come up to Bubba Watson's standards. I think Bubba himself has some personality issues, some temper issues. I don't see him contending this year, although he certainly has the game and the ability to do so. And I think Rory has got to deal with the pressure of knowing that this is the tournament that he needs to win in order to complete the career Grand Slam, and it's a tournament that he's been in position to win and then floundered in the final round.
Famously and spectacularly in one place, yes.
He's got to deal with that when he comes to the final round on Sunday if he's in contention. We'll see how he does. I certainly think of all the players in the field, Rory is the most talented at the moment and the one that has the most complete game. But I still like Jason Day.
Yeah, I think he's come close and he has not shown signs of choking in a major. He's lost for other reasons and he really wants it, and he's good. I would agree that Day and Spieth and McIlroy are the top three. I don't see Kuchar getting it done, but you never know. Golf's a funny game. So we will see, and we will hold you to those predictions. And thank you, Bob. I hope we have a chance to play again at some point.
Well, you know, Rock Creek Park is still waiting for us.
Yeah, so. Unfortunately, now it's a 3.5-hour drive from where I live, but
I'll get down to Washington every now and then. You've got to be able to bring. Are you still using my old driver?
I'm. You could have predicted. I think that some as bad a golfer as me would need to make use of the latest technology, and
you put that old club in the garage.
I have. Yes, I'd be happy to. I can bring you any number of old clubs in the garage if you'd like. But maybe I should. Maybe I should bring the clubs on the Amtrak next time you headed down there.
I think you should, definitely. Sometime this summer, we'll get out there.
Okay. Well, in any event, thanks a lot, and I'll be watching this week.
My pleasure, Bob. So will I. Thanks very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care.